Great Country Kid 94. It is the extended version of Coffee with Kyle. We have Prairie du Chien Police Chief Kyle Tenor, and this week we have Basketball Police Chief Jaden McCulloch, brought to you by Dunkin' Donuts here in Prairie du Chien. So, we were talking about meth, and there's a perception, I think, and I'm going to kind of let you guys handle this, but every time I see a news release or something, you know, so-and-so is arrested for methamphetamine related charges, and there's always a barrage of comments. Half of them are good job to the police department for cleaning up our streets, and the other half is, well, they'll be back on the street in 3 days and doing the same thing.
Right.
Yeah, and it falls on, it looks like law enforcement's not doing their job.
Very much. I think there's a big misperception that it's law enforcement's job to get them from point A to either treatment, incarceration, or something like that. What in reality, that's far from the truth. Kyle can attest to this with the Crawford County judicial system, Grant County judicial system. I think they're all very similar in the respect that they have guidelines they have to follow also. And more focus now is being put on treatment, and, you know, incarceration is farther down the line where before it maybe wasn't. Even though the rate of reoffending is still high, I think more focus is being put on treatment. So second chance maybe is a good term.
Yeah.
You know, a lot more second chances are being put out there in hopes that the treatment plans work. But as law enforcement, our job is to identify the crime, make the arrest, refer the charges.
And we have to remember that the people have rights. Like, you can correct. Know somebody is using or selling meth, but you have to have solid proof. You can't just, I mean, you can, but you can't just,
and then you have,
you can't just sit and follow somebody.
Correct. And you have the whole legal process they have to go through to, you know, be convicted of that crime. A mere arrest does not mean they're guilty.
Exactly.
You know, due process has to be done. They have to go through the whole process. You know, and those court cases sometimes take a long time. And just because, you know, the Prairie du Chien Police Department, the Basketball Police Department, Sheriff's Offices, whatever agency it is, arrest somebody doesn't mean that that person's going to sit in a jail cell until that court case is concluded.
Exactly. I think that's a huge misperception as well, that, okay, you get arrested for distribution of methamphetamine.
Correct.
And I think the general public goes, okay, well, they're going to sit in jail now for years. Okay, what's the reality? If you leave here and you pull over somebody for distribution of methamphetamine, how long before they're out?
Well, they'll go, they're arrested and brought to the jail.
Yes.
At that point. But then they go before a judge within 48 hours, and they're afforded a bond hearing. And then the judge decides at that point what their bond should be. And there's a bunch of different factors they consider, you know, past criminal history, seriousness of the crime, was there children involved, all those sort of things. And then the judge sets the bond. And if this individual can meet that bond, then they are released on bond until their court date.
Exactly. So Joe Smith may get arrested for methamphetamine. All of his neighbors see that. Oh, good, they finally got him. Well, then 3 days later, they're like, what's he doing back home? The police are doing nothing about this.
Correct.
Which you did your job.
Yeah, one of the more common things about bond is our judges are very good about putting a random urine analysis requirement, or if it's alcohol-related, random preliminary breath test analysis by law enforcement. So we try to follow up with those folks and hold them to that bond and offer them a urine test. And if they test positive for drugs, then we take them for a blood draw. If they, you know, refuse, we take them to jail for bond violations. And people will see multiple bond violations during the course of their entire case in the court system. And those things pile up. But, you know, Jaden's right. You know, the vast majority of the people we arrest here are not flight risks. They
no.
just aren't. They're going to be here. They've been here a vast majority of their life, and they continue to come back to court. And so That's one of the major factors for judges when they order a cash bond versus a signature bond is that this person likely to come back to court, and the vast majority of our defendants are likely to come back to court. And so as frustrating as it might be, and, you know, we get just as frustrated as the public does.
Because you're arresting the same people over and over.
Right. Well, but, you know, we have the greatest constitution in the world.
Yeah.
And we have to not forget that. And it affords drug possessioners and users the same rights as it affords me. So,
exactly. And remember, everybody is innocent until proven guilty.
Definitely. Yep.
Which, you know, again, going back to the legal system and it being great that you're not going to just be incarcerated because somebody didn't like you or whatnot.
Because of an accusation.
Because of an accusation. So it's kind of that double-edged sword.
Yeah. You know, I'll touch on another part of kind of our hand. A lot of people get worked up on social media about people being released from custody and then becoming informants for law enforcement. And we've talked about this on air before, Lori. You know, my drug investigator is Casey Cox. It is very hard for Casey Cox to knock on somebody's door and ask to buy methamphetamine. It's just doesn't happen, right? And so, again, it's another one of those lenses that we have to see this problem through. And does the problem exist with the end users of a gram or 2 grams of methamphetamine? And I think that is a problem in our community. However, the larger issue is,
where is that coming from?
The people that are making profits off of those users. You know, they're worried about the $40 that they're selling their meth for. I'm worried about the ounce possessioners. I'm worried about the multiple ounces of methamphetamine. I'm worried about the quarter pounds of methamphetamine.
Seems like a lot of methamphetamine.
It is a lot of methamphetamine. And I think to kind of piggyback on what Kyle's saying here is, you know, a lot of the... When I first started investigations, a lot of the meth in the area was being cooked right here in this area.
Okay, this is what I wanted to touch on next.
And now that's probably the farthest thing from the truth. I mean, there's probably some small-time stuff going on here, but a lot of the methamphetamine in this area is the crystal meth that's coming out of your bigger cities, La Crosse, Dubuque, Minneapolis, and coming to this area, being curried to this area, and then distributed in smaller amounts here.
Which we were talking about this off air, but I mean, and you were saying this, but you know, you said it's coming from the major metro areas, you know, Minneapolis, Chicago, all of those places, that's being funneled into the country. Mexico, Asian countries that are funneling it in.
Yeah, a lot of it's the majority, I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you know different, I think the majority of it's coming out of Mexico, being manufactured in Mexico and brought up into the United States.
Yeah, that I mean, he's. If you look at, I pay attention to, like, Department of Homeland Security issues. They issue analysis on where this stuff is coming from. It's coming from Mexico. But, you know, we can talk about...
And we're not trying to be political here.
No, not at all.
That's a straight fact.
Yeah, so we can... I don't get into the legalization of marijuana. That's not a topic that we're going to talk about.
Oh, well, I was going to ask you about that next.
Well, one of the problems that we're experiencing with the legalization of marijuana is the Mexican drug cartels
can't sell it anymore.
And now the demand is being met by domestically produced marijuana.
Yes.
And so the Mexican drug cartels have said, we don't have this demand anymore for our Mexican marijuana because they can make it in America now. And so they have transitioned.
And the cartels are not going to lose out on any money.
No, they need the cash. And so they have recognized there is a demand for methamphetamine. And if there isn't a demand for methamphetamine, they are going to create the demand for methamphetamine and fentanyl and heroin. And they're going to flood our country with those drugs, get people addicted, increase that demand, increase their money, and influence on our country. And that's the reality. And people can say that's false. It's baloney because there are, you know, a lot of intelligence gathered through warrants in the southern border and in Mexico that says that this is exactly what's happening. They're not producing the marijuana that they used to because it's being produced domestically now.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I don't think that anybody, when legalization of marijuana started happening, I don't think anybody thought, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, I had read an article that obviously there was millions of acres of Mexican pot farms, and as the legalization slowly continued to happen throughout the United States, they started plowing under those pot farms and planting poppies.
It is about money.
Right? Yes.
I mean, think of yourself as a small business owner. If I'm a cheesemaker, and all of a sudden people stopped making cheese, or there was a four other cheesemakers that joined my community.
You're going to figure something
else out. I would have to figure out some other way to make money, and that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, and I think it's evidenced by, if you look at the number of people that are addicted to something other than, you know, a marijuana or THC, you're starting to see, I'm starting to see more and more people that you would never think would trend down the methamphetamine road, you know, and it, my wife and I and a couple of our neighbors were talking about a person we know pretty well that has got themselves wrapped into the drug world, and I would have never thought it in a million years, but like Kyle said, you start to see they have to pick a different target, right?
Yeah.
And so your marijuana users are no longer their target.
No.
So they're going to branch out from that and try to get their hands on some other people, which then builds their market. So this person that we're aware of, it really struck me as odd when I heard this about this person. But that being said, you know, there's certain people with addictive personalities that are easily grabbed a hold of, and that's where your gangs find those people. Not saying that this person's gang related at all.
No.
But maybe people that they're tied to have ties to the gangs, and you know, so they're finding crowds, they're finding niches that they can get into, and it's like a spider web. It just kind of keeps going out.
No, again, I want to go back a little bit. So we had talked about this on air on Saturday, but you've both been in law enforcement for right around 20 years. And I know Kyle's talked about this before, that you can kind of almost pinpoint a time when methamphetamine became a problem in this area. And I want to talk about how, okay, thinking about my childhood, even the early 2000s, like hard drugs seemed to be like an inner city problem. You know, cocaine, heroin, I don't even know, crack. I don't even know what it was. It was like, well, you weren't going to find that in a rural community. Because where were they going to get it from?
Well, and I think you could definitely, when I was growing up, of course, that was not anywhere around any part of my family.
No.
But you could distinctly tell who those people were.
Yes.
That were involved in that sort of thing.
Yes.
And now it's a little harder to identify that.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I mean, okay, Kyle, you grew up here in Prairie du Chien. You were a Waseca kid. I'm from Waukon. Very small communities. They're, what, 50 miles apart from each other?
Right.
You know, we grew up knowing everybody in our town, right? And yeah, you had the few outliers that you knew were into some bad things, but it was the outliers. And we talked about this now. Rural communities aren't necessarily set up to handle hard drug addicts either. The resources aren't here.
The resources are not here. And I think there's been a lot more focus lately at the state and the federal level to try to develop more and more of those programs. And there are some new things coming down. I'm working on some stuff. I'm helping work on some things with Gunderson Boscoville, some programs they're working on for some different treatment options, intervention options, stuff like that. So that'll be kind of a neat program if we get that up and running.
But honestly, I mean, we were talking about this problem really exploded in the last, what, 10 to 15 years?
Well, I'll say this. So in rural Prairie du Chien, Crawford County area, I could see like the time frame from 2010 to 2012 was when we worked most of our methamphetamine labs. And when I would give presentations on the methamphetamine, I would say, you know, cooking methamphetamine was distinctly unique to this area, because I could go to True Value and Walmart, and I'm not calling those businesses out, but they had the precursors to manufacture methamphetamine.
Yeah.
And then it became an addiction issue.
Yes.
And so a number of people became addicted based off of one pot, shake and bake, manufactured methamphetamine locally here.
Mm-hmm.
And I always give the analogy, like, there's not a lot of people from Prairie du Chien knocking on doors in La Crosse saying, hey, can I score some methamphetamine? Well, I think that changed with the introduction of laws being passed that you have to show your ID for pseudoephedrine. We incarcerated a number of people that were involved in manufacturing methamphetamine. They started becoming linked together, and the areas of distribution identified an addiction in rural Wisconsin, in rural America. And this isn't unique to Crawford County
or
Grant County or anything. Many counties up north deal with these issues as well. So the core root of this problem is addiction.
Yes.
And addiction and money. And there's money connected to both of them. And so, you know, we're seeing pharmaceutical companies held accountable for the opioid addictions.
Yes.
Right? And
yes.
They're paying huge fines. Well, we need to hold distributors of methamphetamine responsible as well. And those distributors are really gang related. They're, whether it's Asian rooted gangs, you know, motorcycle rooted gangs, whatever it is, that are bringing in these large quantities of methamphetamine into our larger metropolitan areas or Minneapolis's of the world. Those people need to start being held accountable. And that kind of goes back to my my problem with, is the problem in Prairie du Chien our end users, our gram, 2 gram, 3 gram end users, or is the problem our ounce dealers? And that's really where my focus is on my staff is, yes, we need to address the people that are in possession, right? We need to find them treatment options, which we have a treatment court in Crawford County now, which does well. But we also need to work this up the chain and figure out who is responsible for bringing in quantities of methamphetamine and Prairie du Chien and doing it for profit. And those folks are the folks that we really need to target and go after.
And that's when you start working with other agencies. You know, you're. I mean, we talked about this off air too. You know, lacrosse, wherever you're working with them to say, hey, you know, we see this is coming into our our little town. We need your help.
It's a ladder. I mean, like Kyle's talking, the gram users, the half gram users. You know, they're the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And above them is the guy that brought it to Prairie du Chien, and above them is the guy that brought it from, you know, Minneapolis to La Crosse, and, you know, and then the guy from Mexico to Minneapolis. So it's working your way up. I mean, that's...
And you're trying to climb that ladder and figure out, okay, how can we stop it from coming here?
Yeah, one of the problems that I have seen in my career is agencies or people that work in silos and don't share that information. And we are all better when we share information and share resources. And I think that, you know, together we can get a handle on this problem. But as long as there's money involved, it's going to be difficult for us. And as long as people are addicted, it's going to be difficult for us. We can put our heads in the sand. I mean, we can. That's the reality.
Yeah.
Is I can go back to finding these people that are driving seven over and have bald tires and holding them accountable for, you know, maintaining the Trans 305 code. Or we can really focus on the 961 code and state statute and the problems that we see. Bald tires aren't ruining families.
I was just going to say, I mean...
You know, five over isn't ruining families. And although that is a violation of the law...
Oh, yes.
I think we have a responsibility to make our communities more livable, that people can live without fear of crime and disorder. And I think the root of many of those problems is drug use.
And you talk about this, you know, families being destroyed. I mean, that's tapping into, resources in the community
that we just don't have.
Exactly.
I mean, they're here, but they're taxed. I mean,
exactly.
They're at their end.
You know, and you think about, okay, who wants to live next to a guy who's selling meth out of their house? Like, nobody wants that.
Well, and I think Kyle said breaking the cycle is the biggest thing. You know, if we can get the addiction part to stop. I mean, these young children, it's disheartening going into these houses and, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5-year-old, even older or younger children that are going to be raised this way with that, you know, that lifestyle. None of us were raised that way, so we don't really see that, what these kids are seeing.
We have no idea.
We're on the
general
outside
public.
Looking in, but if that child is raised that way, you know, the likelihood that that person then is going to turn to that lifestyle is very high. And I think you're starting to see that now. The children or the younger adults that we were dealing with when we started law enforcement that were the children of
drug
users are now drug users themselves, and not all of them, but
Lori has made it a point to call both of us old several times.
Yes, she has.
Being a cop for 20 years,
I don't think I ever use the word. We are in the same age bracket.
We are now.
I heard old when I walked in.
I am seeing.
Well, I mean, you're both older than me, but I think we fall in the same age bracket, as much as I don't want to admit.
I'm seeing names.
It was just Kyle's birthday.
It was yesterday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. 39 for the record. And I'm not lying. That's not made up. That's 39.
Yeah.
I'm not shortchanging myself. So, again, after...
Do you believe him, Jaden? I mean...
After being in this for 20
I don't know,
years,
so I have to.
Let's stay on task here, people. After being in this for 20 years, I'm now seeing names of children that, you know, I arrested when I worked night shift here for these things. And you see that trend. I'm just going to share a real quick story here, real quick. I was at the high school recently giving a presentation very similar to this topic. But I talked, one of the questions that the kids posed to me was, what is the most difficult crime for you to investigate? And I don't know what they were looking for the answer, but for me, it's crimes against children.
Oh, for
and
sure.
And so I started talking about going into homes that have addiction issues and arresting mom or dad many times for whatever. And a student became emotional in the classroom, and I did not recognize this person. But I later learned that their family members had addiction issues, and we had arrested them many times as police officers. And so that effect on that child will be with them forever. And that's unfortunate. It shouldn't have to be that way.
I want to piggyback off that because I see a lot of times even comments made, you know, when you're talking about this or, you know, somebody, you arrest somebody, they get convicted, they go to prison for 6-8 months a year, okay? And then you see them out, and they fall right back into that same behavior that they were doing before.
Yeah.
Now, okay, say we're in a metropolitan area, because when you're released from prison, you go back to...
Where, go back to the jurisdiction.
Initially, yeah.
Yeah, you
initially
go back to...
Go
okay.
back to the jurisdiction.
So, say you're in Chicago. You're in Minneapolis. There is a large population of people that you, one, have not met, and you would have a chance to go, okay, I'm moving out of this neighborhood. You know, I'm getting away from here. Let's think Crawford County, El McKee County, Grant County. You get released from prison and you move back to your small town. How are you going to hide from the people that you were struggling with before?
You're not. And I think that's where the addiction and substance abuse counseling support groups and all those different entities come together. And the person, quite honestly, has to want to get away from that lifestyle. You know, I mean, they may still live here, but there's so many opportunities to work, you know, build a better family. And you can look around. It is, at the same time, yes, they may have their group of acquaintances that they were associated with, but there's also a good group of, or a big group of good citizens that they can then, you know, work with.
Well, and I think too, because we're in these small communities and, you know, XYZ gets arrested and then they get released, that person has a reputation.
Yeah.
Because we're in a small community. We are in small communities.
Right. Well, this just came up this past week as we released a number of press releases that our canine was involved in, and, and a news media outlet reached out to me and said, there's names excluded from some of these releases. Could you provide them to me? And I went to Lieutenant Cox and said, hey, why weren't these names included? And he said, well, the one arrest involved some small children that were involved, and we did not want to then have those kids be teased at school because their parents were arrested.
Rightfully so.
The other person had just started a job and were caught with methamphetamine, and they're like, I'm going to lose my job. Like, I just got this job. I want to keep my job. I want to keep employed. That type of thing. And so I explained that to the news outlet that reached out and just said, hey, you know, we're trying to curb that shaming because that's not what our job is to do. This person just became gainfully employed, and we want to keep them contributing positively to our community, and so that's why we didn't release the names. Now, they could get the names through an open records request very easily, and I have to provide that, right? But they understood and went about their day, and so that's important. But you're right. For as many examples as we can say, these people came out and relapsed, right? I can give you a few examples of people that I still stay in touch with that went to prison and have since come out and have tried very hard to contribute positively to their families, have been successful, but still struggle with those same connections that think nothing of getting them to relapse. And I get Facebook messages, text messages, phone calls at my office saying, hey, please, this guy, this gal is pushing drugs on me and my people that I know. Please get them locked up because eventually I'm going to give in and I'm going to give them $40 and I'm going to relapse and I don't want to. And so for as many stories as we can share of people relapsing, I have very good success stories of people that have come out of prison, have changed their lives, and are contributing great things to our community.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's important too, and we talked about this, the resources that small communities aren't used to providing, you know, the treatment, the, you know, addiction help and all that stuff. It wasn't something, I mean, that was an issue 25 years ago. I mean, AA was probably the most common one, right?
Yeah.
I mean, now it's, and which is obviously still a problem too, but, you know, getting these resources and getting people to understand that these resources are available as well.
Right. And I think, like I said a little earlier, getting these individuals to want the help, want to better themselves, want to better their family, you know, and that's the biggest thing too, is the addictions are hard to fight. We all understand that. The connections with the people that supported your addiction are hard to fight. But ultimately, these people have to want to make themselves better. They want to be a better person. And that's where your support groups and your counseling and treatment come in.
Which, like I said, this has been, I feel like this is like more heavy than we normally do.
Yeah, I almost feel like we need some experts in here.
Experts? Well, I mean, that's why I brought you guys. What are you talking
about? Well, like I said earlier, like we don't have so many sets of handcuffs, and we can't arrest our way out of this. And
arresting somebody does not stop the problem of addiction.
Oh, crime. No, not even close.
It doesn't. I mean, arresting a drunk driver does not stop them from cracking a beer the next day.
I mean, here's an example. I had one of the gentlemen I talked about. So he was in prison for 18 months, and he told me when he got out, just a few nights before he was released, he had a dream of shooting up with methamphetamine. So 18 months, no access to methamphetamine, and the addiction in your brain is still there. That connection to need and want is still there. So arrest and incarceration is not the solution to this problem. It just isn't. And as many people as want to comment on social media that they're just going to be right back out, well, sometimes that's the best route to get these people the help that they need, because incarceration in the county jail or state
prison
system,
it does not help with the addiction problem. No.
The resources just aren't there. Even in the prison system, they're not there.
Exactly. Now, is that something that also needs reform? Does there need to be more addiction treatment in prison?
Maybe. How much money do we have?
I don't know. But you would think that would be a problem that, okay, if we start treating the addiction issues in prison, I mean, how...
And I'm sure there are programs that they...
I don't spend a lot of time in prisons.
Yeah. No, and I'm not real well-versed with what goes on behind those walls in those prisons, as far as, you know, I know at certain sentence guidelines, you know, must seek out treatment while in prison or incarcerated.
Gene, you talked about it, though. They have to come to that point where
they want it, and they recognize it.
And I don't know that addiction in the first 18, 24, 36 months can get you there.
Well, and I mean, again, I keep bringing up, you know, somebody gets arrested for an OWI. I mean, what are the odds that they're never going to crack a beer again?
Slim to none.
I mean, you know, being addicted to methamphetamine or opioids isn't much different than drinking a couple beers. I mean, just because you got caught one time, you got arrested, you had to pay a fine, doesn't stop you from drinking beer.
No. And I think a lot of it, I listened to a judge that was, it's probably 10 years ago, who I respected a lot, and he went through the sentence guidelines and he read them out, and he said that one of the guidelines was punishment. Well, punishment's one thing, you know, somebody that's afraid to do wrong or respects, you know, that they did something wrong is going to learn from that punishment. But addiction doesn't see punishment.
No, it sees withdrawal.
Right.
And I mean, obviously, everybody's brains are wired differently, and you know, addictive personalities and whatnot. And I don't know that we've talked about this that much, but you know, there are people who've been addicted to methamphetamine, and literally, what it does to your brain.
Yeah, changes a lot.
It changes the chemistry in your brain, and once you have that substance, your brain just wants it more.
Yeah, I mean, that you just got to the root of the problem that we're facing.
Right. Which I don't know what the answer is to solve it.
I think I mentioned that like 2 minutes ago. We need to bring the experts in. We need to find these experts and bring them in.
We need to find some like addiction experts or something. I don't know any, if you guys know any, but I mean, you can read all of the books, but until somebody again makes that conscious decision, I'm going to fight this addiction.
Right, I don't know that, you know, Kyle, myself, you, Lori, I don't know that any of us would be able to ever say, this is why I tried, you know, this drug.
Or, oh,
you
yeah.
know, what the allure is to keep using this drug.
Well, and we've even talked off air. I've said to people, I've joked about it. What makes you go, you know what? I'm going to try some methamphetamine. It seems like it would be really fun. And it doesn't seem like this is a bad drug at all. Like what series of events led you to think that your only escape is methamphetamine?
Right.
Which is, again, going to another one of the root causes, because
I think it goes right back, you know, it starts back in these young children that are raised in these environments, and all of a sudden, that's all they've known their whole life. So then they get up, they're still hanging around these people. You know, their parents' friends, they're co-mingled.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, these kids, you know, little Johnny's buddy, Timmy, said, hey, try this. And then the cycle started.
They feel the escape, because meth does get you high, heroin, marijuana. I mean, alcohol. Yeah. Like, why? Look at me. I miss a glass of wine at night. Why do I have a glass of wine? Because I'm an adult and I had a long day. It's my release. Okay, well, I thankfully stop at wine. But, you know, okay, somebody who's...
Did you say one or wine?
Well, it is Saturday, so I can have more than one glass of wine. Right. On weeknights, only one glass of wine. I got to get up early, Kyle.
Right.
But, you know, for somebody who's grown up in a home with problems, or even just internal problems, you know, mental illness or just, you know, depression, wanting to fit in, and you feel that escape from the drug, you feel that high. And now you want to match that high.
I think there's probably something to be said for those that are addicted. I have a feeling that there's a number of them that could trace it back to a life event or a traumatic yeah. event in their life that caused them to, you know, make that decision. So, you know, unfortunately, we have a hard time of, again, in a rural area, recognizing trauma and treating trauma and doing it proactively so it doesn't resort to more negative choices down the road. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a constant struggle. I know that I'm not giving up. My staff's not giving up. I know Chief McCulloch's not going to give up in his efforts. And but going back to kind of your first question, it's very thankless. I mean, it just is. Nobody is throwing a bunch of high fives to us for making arrests. We, you know, it's just not there. And we understand that. That's not what we do it for. But it's a continuous effort, and it has to be.
Well, and I think the frustration that you guys probably see, I know we've talked about this off air, the frustration that you see, okay, you've arrested somebody, you know they went to prison, and then 6 months out of prison, you see them relapse. I mean, that has got to be kind of a gut punch to you guys as law enforcement, because you want them to be better. You don't want to arrest people multiple yeah. times. Right. You don't want to see people multiple times.
No, but you also, you know, we're normal people also. I try not to dwell on those things, because there's certain things you can and cannot change.
Mm-hmm.
You try to get the person to this point where they are now faced with that decision, that
yep.
life decision for them.
Mm-hmm.
Do I take this treatment avenue, or do I relapse and go back the other direction? And sometimes maybe it's getting them to that point two or three times before they realize, all right, maybe I better try this, you know, the treatment, or, you know, maybe inpatient treatment avenue versus the other road. So you can't dwell on how often the people we deal with go back to their roots, per se. I guess our goal is just to keep getting them to that point where
trying to help.
They have that option. You know, again, they have to make that choice also.
Yeah, and I think one of the topics that we haven't talked about, maybe for a different day, is all of the interconnected crime that's related to addiction, and from property crimes, thefts. You know, we especially this time of year, we start dealing with a lot of garage entries, vehicle entries,
campers.
Yeah, campers, those types of things, and a lot of those things we can root right back to addiction, and specifically methamphetamine addiction, because they're stealing things to either pawn it, sell it, trade it, what have you. To feed their addiction. So the you know, the thing for me is like the 70-year-old person who calls us and says, you know, I've left my garage door open for the last 50 years when I've lived in Prairie du Chien and never had any problems, and now I'm missing all my power tools. That person should be able to leave their garage door open for the next 20 years without any issues. Unfortunately, times have changed, and so now we respond as a police department to say, well, we're sorry that this has to happen. But we can probably tell you the root cause of why it did. So we can get into all that stuff.
That's a conversation for another day, because apparently we have to keep doing this.
Well, we'll be back next Saturday.
We will be back next Saturday. Happy belated birthday once again. Jaden, you had your first Dunkin' Donuts today.
I did. I don't think I've ever had it before.
You finished it, so it must have been.
It wasn't bad.
It must have been good.
I'm more into the just regular black coffee.
You and yours had cream and sugar. Mine did not have cream and sugar. So a little closer to the black coffee there. So
Dunkin' sells black coffee, by the way.
I know. I drink it a lot.
Well, you both could have had that.
Well, I was trying to give him something fun and new. Right. I didn't know. I guessed on your order. I got it wrong.
Yeah, it's okay. I drank it.
You know,
That's the thing about Dunkin', is you're going to drink it regardless.
Exactly. It's Coffee with Kyle, the extended version from Dunkin' Donuts here in Prairie du Chien. Thank you to Basketball Police Chief Jaden McCulloch for coming in and joining us today. Again, thanks to Prairie du Chien Police Chief Kyle Tenor. Coffee with Kyle here on Q94.